And I guess in case you didn't realize, I am a mathematician. I'm trained in mathematics and scientific computing, and I have been very fortunate because I was trained actually by a medical physicist in terms of learning the problem for 3 years at Memorial Sloan. So I should at least be very thankful that the medical physicist really taught me a lot of things. So as you notice that the title itself, I talk about cancer treatment. And radiation therapy, in some sense, is not so different from other type of cancer treatment because what you really want is to optimize or to maximize the tumor control probability and trying to lower the normal tissue complication, no matter what you are trying to actually look at. And I just want to mention, like, some of the work that we do is involve, of course, radiation therapy, involve also optimal chemotherapy, exactly what type of drugs that are combined together to get the optimal treatment. Combined modality involves the biological imaging as well as a hormonal treatment coupled with radiation therapy and what is the outcome related to that. And of course, there are many different types of things. And you notice that I will not go through all of the others, but just to give you an idea, some of the techniques in computational method itself will be applicable to others. Like especially in combined modality, when you actually use biological information, you can definitely incorporate that, not just in radiation therapy, but in other type of treatments. I think I will skip the brief introduction to IMRT. I think everyone knows more than me. And then I will jump right into the large-scale computational model and software that we have designed for treatment planning. And then I will talk about the 4D treatment planning design and how we actually can manage the organ motion. And then I will briefly talk about multiple objective treatment, and that will lead to Joe is going to talk in detail how multiple objective treatment planning is used in a clinical setting. So, like I say, I'm going to skip that. But one of the things that I do want to mention is the following, is that even if we are looking at the IMRT method itself, without organ motion, is already a very complex problem because if you want to incorporate all the parameters within one single optimization system, I mean one single optimization system, then you're talking about a problem that has millions of variables, right? And why are we looking at it? The idea is that I was always being asked to look at the problems when I was a graduate student. My advisor told me, in order for me to graduate, I have to finish solving this 13 million variable that nobody can solve. So that was the challenge. And in this case, some of these instances that you're looking at is million variable problem. And the inspiration here is not only you're making a difference in terms of the treatment planning design, you also advance the mathematics itself. So that's the challenge. So just to remind you some of the variables here. And so we have the gantry angles and beam angles, couch angles, energy. All of this you can couple it within the optimization system. You can actually, of course, look at the fluence and all the beamlet intensity. So if we look at the optimization itself, it's basically we have the 3D image, or in this case, we are looking at 4D imaging, and then there's the delineation of the target volumes. And I guess everybody talks about how do we actually know the target, or if the clinician doesn't give you an exact target, what exactly are you going to expect? So the idea of optimization, and I'm going to avoid the word robust because it is really, when you really think about a problem and a solution, what you would like a solution is that I do not care if the physician is going to outline the region, say 1 millimeter off, my solution should be good. Right? That is really what I want. If the dose calculation is off by 2%, 5%, my solution still has to be good. If the dose calculation is off by 10%, now, obviously you do not like that, right? But if I'm going to go through a fuzzy zone of what the input data is, I would like my solution to be as stable as possible so that I know I can trust the solution and the outcome of it. That's what I'm going to target at. So just to note, I really didn't expect that some of this information actually come out from this workshop, the discussion, even though Joe has been telling me all this time that we must do automatic segmentation. And we actually, those arrows that I put down here is related to some of the work that my group has been working on at Georgia Tech, and I actually got really good information out of that. We are doing biological imaging coupling within the radiation treatment planning. We're using 4D optimization. And I think Citric should get all the credit, Citric Yu from University of Maryland, because he gave me this large data set of 4D images. And basically, he wants us to do some of the optimization on it. But what he didn't give us, there is no segmentation. So when I talked to his postdoc, and he said, oh, if we have to outline all these contours, it will take us a a long time to do it. I said, okay, fine, we'll do it ourselves. So basically what we actually end up is that we build a computer algorithm that actually automatically segment all these tumor regions and all the critical structures. So as it turns out, it's actually very useful. And for today, I will mention about really is that how do we actually use large-scale optimization to handle some of these problems. So just to give you some idea, I think because some of the talks mentioned about most of the optimization that is being done focus on all by the mathematician or the pure mathematician is focusing on the fluence map optimization, which is really only part of it, right? As we notice that how hard are these problems? I know everybody knows how hard they are, but I'm going to give you maybe from the mathematical point of view some theoretical issue related to that. And I guess my screen is too high resolution to be projected down here. Sorry about that. So the choice of beam angles is a combinatorial problem. It's anti-hard. So there has been work, heuristic approach, genetic algorithms, computational geometry related to how to select beam angles, pre-selecting them. And then there are groups of people that are doing linear programming, non-linear programming, every type of approach that you can think of to do fluent snap optimization. And afterwards, you can do actually leaf sequencing. And leaf sequencing turns out if you actually want to develop a leaf sequencing for the step and shoot method in which you have the minimum beam on time as well as the minimum segment, that is another integer program. It's very difficult, but you can actually solve some of these using heuristic approach. Then there is also a method where you can directly do the amplitude-based models where you actually optimize just with segments. Now, this is very appealing, and I know a lot of there are several of the commercial systems actually use that. Part of the reason is because the solution that comes out can be used directly, right? It is something that you can just deliver right to the patient. And of course, if we look at just the optimization itself, doing optimization of beam angles and fluence map itself, you can use a mixed integer programming approach, but the solution that you come back may not be, in a sense, deliverable. Right, so that's the leaf sequencing determination. So this is really for the optimizer. If you want to dive into this, this is what you see is that very difficult problem to do. And what we notice are also the following. At each stage of the optimization within RMRT, if you're going to pick one of these problems to solve, you know that you are far from optimal, right? Obviously, because you are only solving a subproblem. But if you combine all of them, your solution is more global. So that's the difference also between the optimization. Some of the facts that I should mention is that RMRT instances are very large scale, and I cannot quantify it from the commercial standpoint how large an instance that you guys are looking at. But from the point of view of a mathematician, we can actually build a system that is like in the order of millions of variables. And we are not talking about the variables that are continuous. We talk about discrete variables. So there exists almost very little method out there that actually can tackle this type of problem. If we want to think big, okay. So now just to remind you the size, there's the beam geometry. You have the candidate set of beams. You have couch angles, collimator size. You can actually put in the energy. We actually did that. And you can put in also the number of isocenters. In the case of like brain tumor, you actually have multiple isocenters. And you have the continuous variables that represent the beam intensity. Then the type of constraints that you want. Basically, there's really no limitation on what type of constraints you want. Because if you are going to use continuous variables and discrete variables, you can actually build very beautiful constraints of the DVH and everything that you want. The only thing that is hard is, can we actually solve the problem? So some of the challenges, and it seems like we actually cover that today very beautifully by many of the speakers. If we can produce optimized plan readily, now by optimized, here's what I mean. You solve a mathematical problem, solve it to optimality, and that is optimized with respect to the objective that you choose. So that's really what we mean. So now, how can we ensure that we actually, the solutions that come out deliver exactly the dose that you want, right? So that's different than actually you deliver the dose, because it's not clear whether you... The second thing is the forgiveness, and that's what I meant, the solution, how stable it is. Is that if you actually made a little error in your dose calculation, not the whole dose engine, but just maybe there are several of these input, they are not correct. How much can you trust the solution? Luckily, many of the solutions that we get actually are very good. It's very forgiving because they actually are optimal within a very good set of parameters. Now the next thing is that if we actually could build all these things, how do we actually incorporate all the motion? How much information do we want? So we talk about all the information from body imaging. Should we use all of them? Should we use partial information? So how are we going to select that? And also, of course, the idea of planning tumor volume. The interesting thing, actually, Joe was there in the one of the workshops that we have with the NCI NSF sponsored workshop. We had exactly 10 physicians, and none of them agree on a single tumor site. In fact, it's really beautiful because the moment one of the person put in the tumor, you know, the outline, everyone is arguing, all the clinicians. So we don't have to say anything because it's very clear that this is an issue. But on the other hand, as I mentioned, is that if somebody's going to give you a tumor region, you will not be really doing a good job if your optimization only is optimal when that is the exact tumor. You really would like that solution to be very stable and not sensitive around that region, right, the fuzzy region of it. So, and that one we are very fortunate because we have a very nice model that actually cope with it, still with very nicely. And of course, the last thing is how do you actually find a steering objective for all this information? So for this talk, I'm going to focus on the experience that we have in a system that we have built for computational modeling as well as for solving these type of instances. Basically, we find the beam angles as well as the IntensiMAP simultaneously. And I will mention a little bit about how we can actually incorporate organ motion within it and some of the ideas of multi-projective. So this is something that I think I'm just putting it out for the mathematicians. And these are the type of criteria that the clinician may give us, is that they would like the coverage, they want to know the prescription dose is met, and they want to make sure that the dose to the critical structure is minimized. And then there are a whole bunch of other considerations. The most important thing is now, what type of models are we choosing? So there are two things. I'm going to be very simplistic for this particular talk, is that I'm going to just separate the algorithm part into just the linear and non-linear convex case into the polynomial time part, and then there's the NP-hard part in which there exists no polynomial time algorithm for some of these problems. So there's the non-linear, non-convex case, and there's the discrete optimization where you can have linear, non-linear, and also discrete variables within it. So there's the deterministic side, and there's also the probabilistic and stochastic side. So probabilistic side, clearly, why do we have the probabilistic side? It's because for those voxels that are at the margin between the tumor and the critical structure, like the prostate wall, so that's, you will want to know exactly at which phase that's going to be tumor and at which phase is going to be a critical structure. So that's basically what I outlined. Now, some of your favorite algorithms, if it is not there, it's just because I cannot put all of these in. So we have polynomial time, NP-complete, and NP-hard. So my world is in the very biased, of course, I'm a discrete person. So I'm in the NP-complete world, and that's what my work is in. And some of the exact algorithms that you know, simplex method, gradient-based, interior point, Newton-type methods, or you have the exact algorithms, branch and bound, and price and cut, which belongs to the discrete optimization part. And then there are these heuristic algorithms that you guys know much better, and you use it more often, simulated learning genetic algorithms, and the evolutionary genetic algorithms. So these are the heuristic approach. So what is the difference in terms of the design of the constraints? So basically, if you look at just the dose-based constraint, you can actually use the linear programming or non-linear programming techniques and handle that. For DVH, you can actually model it very beautifully using discrete optimization, in which you really could trace after every single voxel using a constraint. And then for coverage and beam orientation, everything falls into the discrete optimization part. Then you have the EUD and biological information. Now, all these are non-linear parts, so, and they are okay, because we can actually handle them. It's not so much that we cannot handle them, but it is more that what exactly is the clinical meaning of those? Does it really mean anything if I can optimize the TCP and minimize the NTCP? Is the plan going to be better or not? So our method, first of all, this is actually really interesting, is that why do we actually have to build a modeling language? Is that when we first started doing a lot of the computational problems with industry, actually with the airline problems, what we noticed is that every modeling language in the field, they always crash when we actually generate a large instance. And they always crash for radiation therapy instances because the matrix is very dense. Basically, it couldn't even handle that. So we actually have a modeling language that is very beautiful, is that it takes in all the input parameters that you have and then model the problem for you. Okay, so basically just put in all the information. Then we actually develop a solver, obviously that is actually my research area. So the solver actually handles linear, quadratic, and nonlinear mixed integer programming. And for this particular talk, I will focus on the dose probability multiple Jacobson for the voxel information. So we need this discretized PTV and all this information. So one of the information that the mathematician or computational scientists need is the following, is that you really need to understand how much information do you need in the model. So you want enough so that your model is good, but you don't want too much because your model is going to be intractable anyway. Right? Intractable means you cannot solve the problem. So that's a lot harder to actually deal with. So basically we have a set of candidate beams, and these candidate beams actually were selected based on computational geometry to avoid critical structures, direct impact to the critical structures. And there's the beamlets for each of the field is about 900 to 16 beamlets, and we get planning information from the physician and then also the maximum number of beam output. So what type of information do we add in? We have the dose-based constraints, we have the DVH constraint, we have the variable for each of the voxel. So now you can see how big these problems is. Consider if you have a tumor that is about 2,000 voxels, represented by 2,000 voxels, and you have also, let's use 2,000 for all the other five critical structures. So you already have a huge number of, like 10,000 just for the OARs and 2,000 for the PTV. For every one of these guys, I'm going to keep track of them. So I'm going to keep track of what is the dose deviation from the desired dose, and I'm going to record the volume, counting the percentage of it, right? So you see that that's why I use a 0-1 integer. For beam profile, naturally you have the continuous variables to represent the intensity of the beamlet, and you have the diffusion variables to indicate the beam's directions and all the other things. So if you're interested in the mathematics, this is what we have, the intensity and everything, so I'm not going to go through that. So this is one of the instances, like that's a very small part here, just showing you the PTV, okay? So here we see the first constraint just give you the sum of the dose received by every single voxel of the PTV is going to have to be equal to the PR dose, the prescript dose. And we allow some underdose or overdose here. Underdose is going to be less than 10% of the prescription dose, and then this one is overdose, is going to be within 7% of the prescription dose. And I want 95% coverage, right? So that's, you can see how you just count the percentage. And this gives you a PTV coverage, homogeneity, and also how even this dose is in terms of within that. Now the DVH, this is basically, as I mentioned, you guys know much better than what we are doing in terms of that understanding of what the DVH is. Basically, we want to represent this using mathematical programming approach. So here it just tells us that I want to control exactly how many of these voxels actually receive how much percentage of the dose. And this just tells you like the level of percentage. So what you notice is the following. Now this we have not included 4D. And why am I presenting this? This is really just the ordinary IMRT treatment planning. And this is already very big. And how far are we computationally? We are terribly far. If you are going to look at just the whole field of optimization in general, even though we can say, well, look, we can actually solve the fluence map and everything, but let's put all these decision variables inside. They are actually very big instances. If you look at a very competitive MIP solver, and these instances are very hard because of several ways. One is because the, and you all know, notice that, is that the dose matrix, that's what I would call it, the dose matrix, is very dense. It is not like any of the industrial applications where the percentage of non-zeros in the dose, in the matrix itself is less than 1%. All the problems that we solve actually, all the techniques that we have been developed for the last 30 years within optimization deals with very sparse matrix. And we are very good at that because we spend all our life on that. What we also notice is that some of these constraints may not be satisfied simultaneously also, because maybe it's desirable to satisfy certain type of those, but on the other hand, it may not be really reachable in terms of in the optimization sense. So what is the difference between this type of method versus what has been used and what is currently in the commercial system? This is really what the difference is. And this is an exact algorithm. What does it mean? Is that this is an algorithm in which when you actually terminate, you actually get proven optimal solution. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that if you don't terminate, you know exactly how far you are from optimality. Now, this is a classic problem. You go to variance, you put this little nice curve in it, and then it optimizes, right? After certain iterations, what does it do? It gets either stuck there, it stopped there, and it just doesn't do anything, right? Is it optimal? Is it optimal? It's not optimal, right? You know that it's not optimal because you know that somehow if you change a little bit, it starts to move again. So what happens is that those methods is not optimal because, of course, you have local minima, but it doesn't even matter. In the gradient method, at least you actually reach a point where you feel that it's close to the solution. But if you're doing simulated annealing as well as genetic algorithm, you do not even know where you are stuck in the solution space. You are far from optimal, right? So, and now for optimizer, I mean the optimizer in our sense, that means we are obsessed with true solution. So what we would like to see is, okay, fine, you stop here. Tell me exactly how far you are from optimality. And this is the beauty of this algorithm that none of the other algorithms have, is that it has two bounds. When you stop, you know exactly if you're 5%. Why is this so important? So I can only tell you from the industrial applications that we have. So we did some of the applications for the airlines, which I always mention, and for oil industry and for the bank. A solution that is 5% from optimal would save them hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's the end of the story. If 5%, that's all that they need. Do you need to close the gap between 95 to 100? No. I don't care, right? I mean, that's what... And I think that actually is also very nice for maybe for medical physicists or physicians, at least in the validation phase. Because you may, in some sense, I noticed that at least one of the polls that Mark Langer did is that he actually asked the audience, how long did it take them to actually do a plan? How long would they be willing to spend time on a commercial system? And some of them actually spend 2 days. But if you spend 2 days and you are not improving even one single percent, you are really not using your time wisely, right? Maybe you should just move to another phase of the optimization part. So I think this actually really gives you a good indication how far you are and also what type of effort are you willing to move forward. So that's the beauty of it. Of course, by saying that, I don't mean that you should all flock to this method because I would tell you that it is very hard, so it's not. But on the other hand, it is really a beautiful method to actually use. So one of the things that what we do is in this case, is the compensation of the movement. That's, now we are going to get into the tractability strategies. Tractability, by this I mean, how fast can we solve these instances? Remember, we are dealing with NP-complete problems. That means these are not polynomial-time solvable. And so we want to be able to solve them very fast. So how can we do that, and how can we incorporate 4D information? First, one thing you can do is replace the dose matrix by a dose probability distribution. Now you can think of, if you're familiar with what Thomas Barfield did, he has this dose kernel. You can think of this exactly if you replace the dose of a static state by another dose information. Then your problem remains the same, except just the dose is different, right? Another thing that you can actually do for dose approximation is that, because a lot of this matrix is very dense, what you can do is you can decompose the dose into two formats. You can think of it as the scattering cutoff and how far you want to cut it off, or you can just look at the matrix itself and just pick up part of it, and not so much that you're going to forget about it. You're going to use that back after you get the optimization of the first part. In the 4D planning, what we do is that instead of optimizing this system, we actually optimize the whole system that involves the voxels of all the 4D breathing phase. So that's, you can see, if I have a problem that starts with 100,000 variables and 100,000 constraints, and I'm going to increase that by many folds, right, based on how many breathing CD images that I'm going to use. So what is the order of the problem? The size usually is the one that we start solving is about 100,000 to 100,000. Then we do column generation and cut generation. This is really for the for people that are interested in optimization. And you notice that I'm not going to go into detail, but as I mentioned, I do want you to know they are hard, they are not easy. So what we did is that we actually come up with a very fancy theoretical study that actually find a lot of information in the mathematics. So that is the inspiration, as you will ask, what is the, if we are not going to implement our system into the commercial system, why would it be inspirational for us to do? The idea is that you're going to make a big name in your own field with very beautiful theory and computational techniques that nobody can get, because they won't be motivated by these type of problems, right, if they don't see it. They don't see the challenge, right? So that's a very nice part, at least from the research point of view. And that's what I try to motivate my students to do it too, because sometimes it's indeed very frustrating, because the idea, if they go to industry after graduation, they want to do something that just go right into industry. They don't understand it takes a lot of effort to get to that. So this is the computational engine. As you notice, the word parallel appears in many of these, because I got 256 computers actually would work on these things. So yeah, pretty spoiled. So that's the model that we're using. I'm going to show you part one. You will not see any results because we already have done that, and that's the paper that actually came out in the Red Journal just recent in January. So what did we see in the solution? First, the solution that we see, even though the problem is very large, commercial systems cannot solve it after 30 days, we can actually solve it within 30 minutes after we work so hard to come back with the theory and computational part. The results are very good. So the first time I actually didn't show the results. The first time the clinicians see the results, because it takes the medical physics to actually run it through the dose calculation and generate DVH, right, which to us we cannot generate yet. The physician was screaming. They are saying it is so beautiful, the results, that we must implement it in the clinic right away. So this result, you really see a huge difference. You can compare that right away with the clinical system, that it actually drastically reduced the radiation dose to the critical structure and normal tissue. So what we also notice is the following, as some of you have mentioned, is that the intensity is actually very smooth. That's the difference. It's true that some of the optimization, if you actually focus on just the fluence map, you actually may have specs somewhere, and they are not deliverable. But these plans actually are very beautiful. The plans come out with very smooth intensity, and you can actually deliver it in the clinic with very few segments. So that's very nice. But for yes. Yes, indeed. The constraints, I don't know why I came back with that constraints, because the physicist actually asked me a million times exactly that, what were the constraints? And I couldn't really tell them, because my idea is if you ask me a question, and I usually send them all the mathematics in the email, and they come back and say, are there any English between the numbers? So it's really difficult, I think, at the beginning, and now I'm getting better. Okay. Now, it is not really so much about the language barrier. It's really like, we tend to explain everything around the mathematics. Without the mathematics, there's nothing to explain, right? But it's not really how it should work. But I think it's just the symptoms of a mathematician that I have to. I think Joe is really good in really asking me on things to make me explain. But I think I still have that same problem. For these 30 minutes?
No, so you said that commercial systems aren't able to pick up problems from the space. Are you talking about implementation in the cluster? Also, could you know when you try to solve things in parallel?
Well, when I try to solve things in parallel, that is when in the implementation and testing phase. As we finish all the fancy techniques, yeah, we can solve it pretty fast. Now we got something very nice. Commercial system cannot solve it because they cannot even solve the initial LP relaxation fast enough, and they have just a lot of trouble closing the gap. So, yet for the 30 minutes, this is really a sequential. I cannot ask the, will you guys give me 256 notes to solve the instances? Probably not, right? So that would not be usable. But on the other hand, I cannot wait. The problem with me is I'm very impatient. So if I have 10 methods to test, I want to run it on all the machines so that I can see what happens. And I also want to run it on 10 patients instead of one, because I think you you really don't learn enough, even though you say prostate is a prostate. The prostate is not the same prostate. We have 20 patients, and two of them really behave totally different. So if I just run on one, I'm not learning enough in the pattern. So that's why I need a parallel cluster for that. It's just for testing and for fast return. So I'm going to go into the organ motion, because a lot of the talk has been focused on organ motion and also how to do 4D. Now, this one is a crazy idea, because basically what I do is I actually really track every single walk. So there is a deformable imaging algorithms that we have developed. Basically, we track for every single CT scan that go from one phase to another. You actually track exactly whether it's within the PTV or outside the PTV. So basically, that's why we are using that within the entire system. So what do we do? In this case, just to remind you, so yes, I use the word robust, but now that I think there's so much confusion here, now robust here is really easy to understand. You have your favorite algorithm, you have your favorite optimization problem that you want, you apply the robust method to it so that your solution remains very optimal even though you have uncertainties within the data. That's what robust means here. It is not related to a single algorithm or a single model. Okay, so that's really what I meant here. So one thing you can do, and that actually works out really beautifully, is that we really don't care so much about how you actually, like within the breathing cycles, you don't worry so much about how much you actually deliver at that one instance. Because that one instance is going to be insignificant. But the most significant part is that you want the cumulative dose at the very end to be exactly what you want. So what do we replace the matrix A by the sum of the expected dose, of the cumulative dose at the very end of the breathing cycle. So that means at the end of the breathing cycles, as you deliver it across this platform, even though the tumor is moving, every single voxel within this tumor is going to receive exactly, the sum of all those doses is going to be exactly the dose that you want. Okay, so and the solution actually looks really beautiful. The last one is on the 4D image guided one, in which I actually applied the image, all the voxels within the entire system. So that's a huge problem. So I'm going to compare these with the standard PTV, which you know it is not good anyway, but we use it just as a control. And the second one is the ITV that is defined as the union of all the CTVs in all the breathing spaces. And this actually was outlined by the clinician, so and also determined by the clinician, the ITV. And then the last one is the one that we use, the multiple voxels. So these are the solutions. I don't want to... Now, even though there's only one, I cannot really make a 4D image on this, unfortunately, to show you all the slides. So it is a little bit difficult to capture that. But what you notice is the following, and it is expected. If you use the ITV plan, you tend to overdose at the boundaries of the tumor, right? And that's expected, because ITV comprises of all the combinations of all the PPV of all these each slides, right? So you tend to overdose it on some. And if you use the PTV, of course, you notice that this is for the liver here, is that it will be underdosed. So you notice for the 4D one, where we actually track every single voxel, this is a huge, gigantic problem that involves more than 10 million variables, actually. But the result is really good. And I cannot tell you it takes only 30 minutes to solve this problem. It takes a lot longer time. This is really running in parallel. So what we notice is that the target underdose, it managed really well, and we improved the conformity, and we also have a very good coverage. What's more important for these patients, these are the lung cases, is that it actually, for the tumor that is in the left lung, is we reduce the mean dose to the normal tissue that is not the part that has the tumor. We reduce the mean dose by 20%. We also reduce the mean dose to the heart by 20%, and the tumor is actually right next to the heart. So in this case, in a clinical sense, this is very important. Even though one cannot say if it is really the normal tissue complication is lower, the fact is they are proportional. So you can argue that this is better than a higher dose. And of course, the compensation is that the dose actually went to the spinal cord and the right lung, and it's not much, as you notice. For the liver case, we also notice that we reduce the normal liver tissue by 15% in the mean dose, and reduce the 20% mean dose to the normal tissue. So this is systematic. We actually did it on quite a few collections of patients, and all these look quite similar, the result. So it's a very encouraging result. So what did we learn in the second phase? So the first phase, we build this system so that we can actually throw everything in. So now we finally actually use the 4D image and actually design the plan. What we notice is that it is actually very promising to be able to actually incorporate all these things. You can actually account for general setup errors too, not just the systematic breathing errors that we see or breathing motion. But computationally, it's really very challenging. And what's more important is that, at least I will be very excited to see, is I would like to see how much is this going to translate to better clinical outcomes. Right, so that's, from my point of view, that is very interesting if we can actually see clinical outcome on that. So this part, I'm going to go pretty fast because Joe is going to talk about this in detail. And I'm going to say, okay, again, we can use the same computational platform and trying to see, can we actually steer the treatment planning using multiple objectives. So for this one, this is not the famous weighted sum of objectives that we're using. This is really the preemptive programming in which you actually use multiple objectives and you actually resolve the problem with different objectives so that you can actually arrive at the efficient frontier. So what we do is that we use different types of the, as I say, the famous one, as most of you are very familiar with, is the weighted sum approach. You can also do preemptive programming. And goal programming is the one that coupled all the differences in the goals and coupled them within the objectives. So you can also use it along with any favorite optimization algorithms that you want, not just within the MIT, but on the other hand, if you are actually applying it to heuristics, and you know that is the shortcomings of heuristic, right? So you actually do one iteration, your problem optimal, and then you import those information into your model, and then you do another iteration, and you're far from optimal too. So you will never reach the efficient frontier, which is what you really want. It's the very the solution that is not dominated by anyone else. So on the other hand, if you use exact algorithms, you solve it one instance and you are optimal, you solve another round, you continue to remain in the efficient frontier, and that's where the solution set should lie. So we're going to use surrogate objectives. The reason why I would think of this as surrogate is the following, because if somebody tells you the conformity, how good the conformity is and how good the coverage is, from our point of view, it's a number that we use, right, to keep track of that. But from your point of view, it actually involves a whole imaging where you actually look at everything that involves it. So we actually, that I will call it a surrogate objective, and we actually look at just subset of this and see what exactly is happening. So this is the tumor, and I'm going to compare this with a clinical system, a real clinical system. This is the planning directive, and basically it just has some of the standard dose that is given by the clinician and also some of the dose that is given by to the PTV with the minimum dose that is listed, and that is the goal that is ranked. Within the system, I cannot do a screen caption. I'm not so sure whether we can actually do that because for fear that maybe some of you, if you work in a company, you see your system out there, you will kill me. So this one, we actually reproduce the screenshot of what's in the clinic. So basically, you can select the different structures. And like this is, again, for just the mathematics audience, is that so that you can see this is how you can actually select things. That's what they use in the clinic, and it's similar to that. So this is the planning that is obtained within 1.5 days. And the result, the problem with this patient is that it's a pretty hard case to actually do the planning. So what you notice, that's overdose. Now this is one of the things IMRT actually has, that conventional radiation therapy doesn't give you this type of information, is the dose leakage that is totally outside of that. But you can erase that. It's a very beautiful clinical system, commercial system, in which you can actually erase the dose, and I really like that feature. I think the optimizer would like that too. So then you have also some of the dose, underdose within the target. So this is just for easy viewing. So you see that is the, what we see contrast to what the clinician gave us is that the dose homogeneity is exceeding the 15%. And we also see the lower dose that is received by the PTV is lower than what is being prescribed. So basically that's what. Now you notice that the parotid, even though in the literature they use 30 gray, but some of the clinicians actually really choose lower than 30 gray. They want it to be lower. So now, improved plan. This forget about the overdose, because like I say, you can actually remove that very easily. So this is another half a day, improve the plan by changing some of the parameters. This time you notice that the dose is covered totally, and there's some just underdose at the edge. And that's what you want, underdose at the edge. Coverage is much better, homogeneity worsen, and parotid worsen because you actually put more dose to the outside of the, you put more dose in the tumor. So the idea of showing you this is a two-day planning versus the multiple objective plan. And what we can actually do is that we actually improve the homogeneity, we decrease dose to the normal tissue, we decrease drastically the parotid. So that's the plan from the MIP. And we don't really have the dose outside there because we use so much information in the normal tissue to actually deal with it. So clinically, we actually improve the minimum dose to the PTV. Homogeneity is improved, as you notice. The percentage of underdose is a lot lower. And this is a surprise, a very nice surprise, because the parotid gland actually receives a lot less dose. And one of the things I learned from Avi Asbert is that he told me that the parotid gland is really very critical in terms of the dose received by the patient versus the normal tissue complications. So basically, if you can actually get 17 dose and be able to deliver a good plan, that's a good thing to do. So if we look at all the critical structures, what you see is that every single one of them, basically spinal cord, left parotid, right parotid, and brainstem, all the dose actually improved. But what we also notice is that clinicians don't seem to care so much. If you get them the dose and that's what the dose actually satisfy what they want, they don't really care if you can push it lower and lower. But from my point of view, yes, you should care. Because even though we don't know about the normal tissue complication, but I do believe it is totally related to the dose in whatever form that we are not sure exactly how it is. So if we can actually push the normal tissue dose to be as low as possible, that's what we should be doing. So the observation here is that the multiple objective plan actually produced very high quality plan, and the solution, of course, is very sensitive to the order. Now, you can, of course, like in the clinical commercial system, you can already do this in your system. You can pick your favorite optimization engine, and then you just do multiple objective and to improve the solution. And computationally, of course, it is very intensive, because instead of solving the system once, you are solving it multiple times. So this is the general challenge that goes far beyond radiation therapy. First of all, the objective in every single planning that we see, whether it is chemotherapy, radiation therapy, or any other methods, is that the objectives are very complex, and they usually are competing. So another thing is that the biologists are very good in understanding a lot of the biological information, but we actually use very little of those information in terms of within the treatment planning itself, right? So that's actually very important. Are we ready yet in terms of computational method? No, the answer is no. Are we ready to have, in a sense that if you ask us, do we have algorithms that can solve existing problems? Yes. Do we have algorithms to solve the problems that we really care, that we actually could not solve at the moment? Maybe not. Even if we have those algorithms, they're not readily available to, from our hand to your hand, it's still not transparent from that sense. Of course, the element of uncertainty is very high. 4D planning, as we do it, is very promising, and computation challenge, of course, is exceedingly difficult. On the other hand, the expected dose information is give us very good results. So that means we don't need to solve such a complex problem in order to arrive at a good solution. Biological advances is important, but the most important thing is the last sentence. What is exactly is the translational value? How are we going to actually assess that? Now, the another thing, this is the benefit. So I should tell you one of the reason why I put this slide up, because I actually was in Netherlands, and interesting is that in Netherlands they are actually doing advances in healthcare where they want to do not just radiation therapy. So I gave a plenary talk there in January where they want to know how can mathematicians and computer scientists actually help in advances of healthcare in general. So one of the things that I used to, in 1997 when I gave the first talk on brachytherapy, optimization approach in brachytherapy at INFONT. So there were 200 audience. One of the guys, actually they are all guys, it turns out, asked me, so how much money are you talking about? So that's what he asked me. I was pretty upset, because first of all, I think we always make money for the company. Every single thing we do is saving the operation cost, right? That's what we always talk about. So I have no idea how much money we are talking about. So I said, how much money are you willing to give me in order to save your life? That's how much it is. So in that sense, I think from my point of view is that I don't think we are going to measure the, like, what our participation as a mathematician is going to make in terms of the money, because I don't know how much it takes for the patient to pay to get this type of treatment, and how much does it even worth in the optimization part. I bet it's only worth like a couple hundred dollars, right? It's totally worthless. But I think these are more important. First, if I am a patient, I go into the clinic, if I know exactly the system actually give me the solution, it's going to be really worth trusting, right? I have a quality assurance, right? That's what I want. I would like the medical physicists come in, have a very sophisticated system that could help them to get a good solution so that on the day when they are very tired, they still could get a very good plan, right? So that's the first part I think is very important. So treatment planning is no longer operator dependent. So it gives something that you can actually trust, you can validate, right, if you have a system like this. And secondly, if you have a sophisticated system, not only you can actually handle what you have now, you can also look at the models that are more complex and more realistic. So you can push forward the field. So, of course, in this field, this is very interesting field, is that the technology of imaging goes so fast as opposed to the algorithms, which is really unbelievable. I mean, it's in some sense, this is almost exactly like what we see in the airline. So when we first actually started doing the airline problems, you know, airplanes are very sophisticated, right? But, you know, the optimization engine that was inside the system, it was so naive. It is unbelievable that it actually worked, right? But of course, then the optimizer went in and changed everything, but it took a long time for them to even accept that. So basically, I think I see that we are at exactly this junction. So, and I don't think there's no hope, because I think I saw the success already in the airlines. Basically now, if you go to every single airline, you will see our students in every major airline doing optimization.
Sorry, when you say the optimization is very
crude,
is that correct?
For what? With the optimization... Scheduling is very poor, robust. Okay, I can tell you that the scheduling is really poor. I mean, it was very primitive, and so were the whole idea of how to actually handle catastrophic events. They're not good in that. Like a snowstorm, right? A snowstorm, okay, basically everything, they don't know how to handle that very well. And I think that part, we can handle it really well. And on the other hand, it is not so easy to convince them what to do, right? Because if you have been... Now, I think this is an example I just thought about. Maybe it's a good example. So if you were a guy, and many of you happen to be a guy, and if you actually wear a tie every day, if you tie your thing every day in exactly the same manner, and then somebody comes in and says, no, you actually didn't do it right. There's a better way to do it. Will you change? Of course not, right? Because you know so well, this is the things you have done it for 30 years. Why would you change? So it is not an easy thing to, and I think I'm not, medical physics in a sense are very close to mathematicians. At least I feel that way, because I have a lot of good friends that are physicists. So at least I feel that it's really easy in a sense. Can you imagine we are talking to people that actually do not even know, like sometimes we talk to manufacturers that actually have no interest in anything except money, right? So it is impossible to talk to them, because they talk about how much money are you talking about. I said, I am not interested in the money. I'm interested in this problem, right? So it's different. So of course now I put a little thing about the cost savings. But the cost savings is really in terms of, yes, you can actually itemize how much time it takes to shorten your time that's spent in doing that. And I think that is actually important too. Maybe you won't feel that you're richer, but at least you feel your job satisfaction is quite better, right? Because you can actually perform more important things than just spending 2 days in doing the things and seeing minimal return. And also, if you have a complex system like that, you can do very objective analysis on the treatment, on the clinical improvement, because now you have one thing that you can incorporate everything. Like some of the questions asked is, what exactly are we seeing? Are we seeing that we're going to improve the 5% patients that are being left out? No, I see that we are improving in every single front. If you do have a lot of information, so the natural way for human beings to think is, can we do better? this is a good way to say, okay, let's test if we can do better. Maybe we can't, fine. Then we have wasted many years of our effort. But at least you feel good about knowing the answer, right? And if you find that you actually are doing better, that's great. That's one of the nice things about that. So that's the end of the talk, and I'm going to end it with one of the terms that I learned about. That's the only term that we have trouble with medical physics. So when I was giving a talk at Memorial Sloan in 1996, and that's when we started the brachytherapy, so I started with the slides on OR. So what do OR people do? Oh, no, what does it mean by operations research? So OR means operations research. So they actually know everything about OR. In fact, they say, oh yes, of course we know what OR is. So their idea of OR is operating room. And so my idea of OR is operations research. But it's even worse after I said that, because operations research doesn't mean a single thing to just probably millions of people. So because this is an area where it actually came out from World War II, in which the people, the mathematicians, actually were on the warship. What do we do? Since you know, during the war, everything is called operations of something. So these people, their work is labeled as operations research. Their idea is they find the optimal meal plan, optimal operational strategy to do in the during the war time, and also optimal logistic assignment. So that's why we call ourselves operations research people. But I think that's that. At least I would like to tell you how the name of this came in, because I'm a mathematician, but it's a funny thing, because I'm a mathematician that is in an engineering school that is doing operations research. I think it's very confusing. So if there's any communication problem, I think I have seen that many times, and I think we can all overcome that. I think that is the least of our problems. So.